Hello, I'm Linda Huey, and this is Meet the Doctors, the show that lets you hear what doctors have to say about their lives, their work, their passions, and what they foresee for the future. Today's guest is Daniel Chris Allison, an oncology and reconstructive orthopedic surgeon. He can replace an entire femur. And recently, he was deployed in Iraq with the Navy Reserves to patch up Special Forces troops. This episode of Meet the Doctors is brought to you by Complete PT Pool and Land Physical Therapy. Whether you're trying to prevent knee surgery or recovering from shoulder, hip, or back pain, Complete PT offers you the most advanced pool therapy in combination with traditional land therapy. You don't need to know how to swim or even get your hair wet. The 92-degree saltwater pool soothes joints and muscles and helps reduce pain immediately. Visit CompletePT.com. That's CompletePT.com. Now let's meet oncology and orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Chris Allison. We're here with Dr. Daniel Allison, we call him Chris Allison, a specialist in orthopedic oncology and reconstructive surgery at Cedars-Sinai. Welcome to Meet the Doctors.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Now, I met you about 5 years ago. I came in with a patient who was having a very complex hip situation, and he chose you. I guess that's pretty common, isn't it?
I'd like to think so. I'm always honored when a patient chooses me, but I like to take care of difficult conditions and complex conditions. And sometimes people will seek me out, and that's always an honor.
Yeah. And I know that you've done some really interesting things in this field, but let's find out how you got over to this field. I'd like to see, how do people get where they are now? Where were you born and raised?
I was born in London, England, and then we moved shortly thereafter to Tehran, Iran, when it was very American-friendly. It was like the Riviera. It was a lot of jet-setters would go to Tehran, and my mom was teaching English and helping the Shah spread English to the outlying villages through television. It was very progressive at the time. And my dad designed oil drilling equipment. We lived there, and I probably would have spent my whole life there, or at least my early years, but there was a revolution in 79, and we had to leave abruptly.
Wow, what was that like? What do you have to pack one suitcase and go?
Yeah, I don't remember much. I remember a little bit. I remember getting, it was kind of a really rushed thing, and kind of getting thrown into the car, not thrown, but pushed, got into the car quickly. We didn't get to pack up everything. I know most of what I know is from what my mom tells me about it, but we left a lot of things behind, including pictures. My dad's company at the time took it very seriously and knew that there was going to be a problem. And so we rushed out of there. Most of what I remember is after that in terms of my childhood. But I know it was a stressful time for my parents.
Did you fly? Were the airports still open at that point?
They were just nationalizing the airport at the time from what I've been told. And we did fly out of there. But it was about 10 months before they stormed the embassy. So it was getting hectic, but we had a little bit of cushion from the really dangerous time.
Wow, you have an exile story that I from leaving Tehran.
Yeah, and the Farsi was my first language before English. In fact, they thought I was slow at the schools because I wouldn't speak. There were American schools at the time. Half of Tehran was American, or Western at least. And then it turned out I had no problem speaking. I just didn't want to speak English. So I spoke Farsi. So they were relieved when and eventually I learned English well, or better at least. But we bounced around Europe and the Middle East. Or after the Middle East, we bounced around Europe and kind of was in England for a while. And probably would have stayed there longer. But at the time, the British had a system where they discovered early on who should go to college and who should go into manual labor and not go to higher education. And I think because I didn't know English as well, I didn't test very well.
Yeah.
And they told my mom, like, you know, don't expect him to go to college or do anything that involves a higher education or professional degree. He's going to go on this track to kind of do more manual labor things, which is totally fine. But my mom always had this dream of me being a doctor, and she wasn't having it.
Good for mom.
And she's American from Texas. and kind of fought to get me a citizenship, and I got classified as a U.S. citizen born abroad. It took about 2 years of the paperwork and process. So we were around Europe during that time, and then I came to America when I was six.
What countries were you living in? So you probably might speak some French or some German.
Well, we moved to Madrid. Mm-hmm. I didn't speak any Spanish. I don't remember much of that at all. And then Athens for a little while. And then Malta is what I remember the most of, which is an island south of Sicily,
yeah.
Right, very close. And I loved Malta, but my parents liked it for about a year, and that was enough. It's a bit of cabin fever when you live on that island.
Any island, mm-hmm. Even Hawaii.
Yes, even Hawaii. Great to
visit. Wow, what an amazing beginning to your life. Yeah. And then when you were six, where were you? Where did you come?
Moved to Texas, okay. To Houston.
Houston.
And that's where I stayed until I came out here.
Well, let's take it one step at a time. Let's start with where you went to college.
Okay.
Where did you first go to college, and what did you study for your undergraduate degree?
I went to Southern Methodist University, SMU, in Dallas, and I majored in biochemistry because I liked biology and chemistry and sounded like a combination of the two, and also took a lot of liberal arts courses.
Like what kinds? Literature?
Yeah, they had an honors and liberal arts program where it covered all from Western civilization to English literature to current modern American literature. And I just, I think I didn't apply myself enough in high school. So I tried to take that advantage to learn that stuff for real in college.
Now that you were being truthful about speaking English and doing it full time.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. At what specific moment did you know you were going to be a doctor? When your mom put it in your head, or did you have that thought yourself?
Well, I like to say that I became a doctor despite the fact that my mom really wanted me to. She was really pushing on me, and you're a little rebellious as a kid, so mm-hmm. I looked at every other field. But I loved science, and I loved anatomy when we did that in school, especially in middle school. And I always had that in the back of my head, but I tried in college many different jobs. And the one I liked the most was the one I didn't get paid for, which was volunteering in a hospital.
Oh, and that's how you got started. You volunteered in a hospital.
And I had exposure to really great surgeons in Houston. That's where they pioneered much of heart surgery. The first total artificial heart was implanted by Dr. Cooley in 1969. And I actually got to meet him in high school, not on a medical basis, but just because his daughter was in my graduating class in high school.
And that's very cool.
And you get to see, and we had such great respect for him. And he was such a great guy that, that played a role in me wanting to be like that.
Mm-hmm. I can understand that completely. So then you went to medical school at Baylor College of Medicine.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
That was fantastic because that's actually where Dr. Cooley was for a while. It's part of the Texas Medical Center. It was just a great school. They really focused on clinical applications early. So they accelerated the book portion of medical school to 1.5 years and got us into clinics. That really helps you do well on the boards because the board exams are really clinical. It was great. I loved medical school. I didn't think it was stressful at all. I did way better in medical school than I did in college.
You kept getting better over the years.
Yeah, I got better and better. I loved it. I enjoyed reading, and even in fields that I knew I wasn't going to go into. And I liked it. We had great professors. And so I definitely appreciate what the school did for me.
And the same year that you graduated from Baylor College of Medicine, you earned an MBA in healthcare management administration. How did you do those two at the same time?
It was a program that was set up with the school. We were the first year that actually did it. And I like trying new things and taking different risks. And that was one that seemed worth taking an extra year for. So they basically expanded the year for another year. So instead of 4 years, it would be 5 years, but you'd get your MD and your MBA at the same time. And also didn't know for sure what field of medicine I really wanted to go into. I knew I wanted to be a surgeon, but I didn't know for sure which field. So it gave me a little time to grow up and think about things. And I didn't have any business knowledge or experience. And I was looking to at least get the basics of economics, finance, accounting, and marketing just to learn more things.
Most doctors don't have much business experience. Mm-hmm. So what are the most important things that you apply to your work that you learned there?
You know, when you get an MBA, traditionally you work first and you get some business experience and then you go back and mm-hmm. perform the MBA. And I had no work experience, neither of the other. There were three other of my classmates were in. So I find myself looking back at the MBA program and now applying what I know from my work experience to that. But the one thing I got out of it, my favorite class was negotiations.
Ah.
And it was the only class I got an A in business school. I got B's and everything else because I was not very good at it. And I, you know, it wasn't like medical school where I really thirsted for the knowledge. But I love negotiations. And there's a book called Getting to Yes. And it was a whole new different way of looking at negotiations.
I read that book. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's been influential in my life because it applies to relationships. It applies to friendships and applies to business. So I commonly go back to that. And certainly just learning the basics of finance, even though I found it really boring. And marketing I found to be really interesting. And the way human psychology applies to the decisions people make. And then economics is fascinating to me as well, because it doesn't always make sense.
Just like the times we're in right now, when mm-hmm. you watch the stock market go one way and then the other way, and all these mm-hmm. talking heads trying to tell us what's happening.
Exactly.
Where did you do your internship?
So as part of combined with my residency at University of Southern California, Los Angeles County.
Mm-hmm. So they combined that. And in your fellowship, you stayed there for a long time. How many years was that?
It was 6 years total. And I stayed there because LA County is just a great place to get experience. You feel like you're contributing to the community and you're learning at the same time. And the patients are usually really grateful. And so I got, you know, a couple of thousand surgeries under my belt.
Wow.
A lot of which I was, you know, very actively involved. So we came out of there with much more experience than somebody maybe from one of the Ivy Leagues that was just watching people operate the whole time.
Well, you had a lot of emergencies coming into mm-hmm. County USC all the time.
Absolutely. Yeah, high-level emergencies and a lot of good experience.
So that is probably something that led to your level of competency that you have in being able to deal with anything that happens to the mm-hmm. skeletal system.
Yeah, it helped. And we had great attendings too. Like Dr. Clapper is now my colleague and friend. He was one of my attendings when I was at LA County. He would volunteer his time and come over and teach us how to do arthroscopy at the H. Claude Hudson Clinic. And I remember, I don't know if he remembers me, but I really remember him. I would take all the pearls. He was very generous about telling us pearls. And I remember every single one of them. And in fact, one of them I use to this day. I do a lot of complex revision surgery. Mm-hmm. And he told me, I never forget him telling me, you know, if you do something someone else did, like when you're trying to correct a problem, odds are you're going to get the same result. So sometimes you go into surgery and think, oh, well, I could have done it better than them and I do it. But he was so smart. It's usually the surgeon did the best job they could do, and it was just not the right way to do it. And so you learn, if you go and try to repeat that and do what they did over again, you're just going to get the same result. So you've got to look at something new and try to look at it from a different angle. So little things like that. Having professors like him was really important for me in my education.
You know, I've known him almost 20 years, and I never knew he volunteered mm-hmm. at County
USC. He did. And he
very generous man, and he's quiet about it.
He's quiet about it. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have to brag for him.
Yeah. Now, how did you get here to Cedars?
I was at USC on faculty there with my mentor who I did fellowship under, Dr. Menendez, who's a great surgeon. He's back over there now. And I did everything with him. He brought me in as faculty and we were very close. And so there were some changes at USC, and the decision was made that he was going to go over to Cedars, and I was going to go wherever he went. And,
it was just, you just followed.
Mm-hmm. So I followed him over here, and I'm really glad I did. And I've been here ever since. That was about 6 years ago.
And so what was he doing here?
The same orthopedic oncology, uh-huh. as well as reconstructive surgery. So I learned under him, and that's where I got my training. And then he was here, and then he elected to go back to USC about a year later.
Were here now, and what kept you?
I was here, and I was set, and I was like, I can't do any more moving around. I was just really establishing my practice, and I thought it would be best for me to stay.
I bet Cedars is glad.
I hope so.
Now, I looked at your website, and it refers to three areas of expertise that seem pretty advanced to me. The first one says orthopedic tumors, mm-hmm. bone and soft tissue tumors, plus you have to put it all back together and make it work, mm-hmm. function well, too. Mm-hmm. So can you give me some examples of what that might be?
Yeah. So in the field of orthopedic oncology, we treat tumors and tumor-like conditions of the extremities and the pelvis. So sometimes we don't have to do anything, but sometimes you have to surgically remove mm-hmm. the tumor. And sometimes when you remove the tumor, you have to take tissue in order to get the margin, especially if it's a cancer.
Yeah.
Or if the tumor is already destroyed tissue, you have to figure out how to reconstruct that tissue. And sometimes it means moving soft tissues around, but other times it means reconstructing large bone defects and large segments of bone. In the tumor world, we're lucky enough to have advances in technology where we can reconstruct really large defects in bone with prostheses. And that includes even an entire femur, half of a pelvis.
Wait a minute, let's back up. You can reconstruct an entire femur.
Mm-hmm. They make a total femoral replacement.
So you start up at the acetabulum, the socket side of the hip joint, and you put a new ball into the socket, and then the whole femur all the way down, the whole bone is being replaced.
If you have to. Certainly we don't jump to that, but there are some cases in which the entire femur has to be removed. More commonly, I'll see it just after end-stage problems with the joint replacements, where if they've gone awry in certain ways or have infections and the bone gets lost, then we have to fall back on that, or some severe cancers that really take up the entire femur.
And what do you do? I think this is one of the stories that captivated me when I met you 5 years ago. You talked about taking out the middle part of the femur because there was cancer in all of that, and you had to reconstruct the accurate length of the femur with what?
So when you take out a middle segment of bone, that's called an intercalary or something that's in between, but we call it, the phrase we use is intercalary prosthesis, that has stems that go in each side of the bone above and below and lock, just similar to a traditional implant.
Ah.
But you have to measure it perfectly because, as you can imagine, it you have to have the implant that's a perfect size and it's got to match exactly what you take out. If you upsize it or downsize it, you're going to leave that patient long or short. Mm-hmm. And people don't like a big limb length discrepancy.
No, no, no. They'd hate it even a half inch after a total hip surgery. Mm-hmm. If they were off in the first place and then somehow it feels worse afterwards.
Yeah.
So how many of those have you done? Like dozens, hundreds?
Well, the intercalaries are less common. I probably have done dozens of them, but when it comes to the ones that involve the joint, where you're actually replacing a large segment of bone with the joint itself, those are much more common. Those I've definitely done hundreds of.
That's at the hip usually, or is it at the knee usually?
Both. It's more commonly the knee, but especially in our adolescents and children with osteosarcoma, most commonly occurs around the knee.
So that's a tumor in the bone.
In the bone, close to the joint usually. Mm-hmm. But the prostheses that we have really do a great job of reconstructing that and giving people, you wouldn't be able to tell just when you see them walk unless you looked at their scar or their x-rays.
And did they tell you that feels normal, or what do they tell you?
After a year. Mm-hmm. But those surgeries require long recovery, especially if the children are on chemotherapy. But they feel pretty darn normal by a year. Now, we aren't able to do that in all parts of the body. But around the knee, especially the end of the femur close to the knee, that reconstructs really well.
What about the tibia, the shin bone?
Yeah, so that's the same thing. That's a little more complicated because you have to get the patellar tendon to heal down to the down to the implant. Because if you can't straighten your knee, then it's very difficult to walk.
How good is it? Yeah.
And there is one implant that I like to use that's got a great ingrowth surface. And then we also move some of the muscle around from the back of the calf, the gastrocnemius half of that. On top of that, to really add that extra layer of healing and protection. And,
So instead of you're extending your leg instead of it pushing up the under your toes.
Yep, and so you can get it to heal down, and we've been able to get people to pretty routinely get full extension with no lag, where it doesn't drop down. So they're full active extension.
Who created that technique?
Our friends at Zimmer. So, probably, and I have to find out who that surgeon is and tell them. But
that's the implant.
The technique
company.
I learned from Malawar, who has a great book that he generously puts online that anyone can download all the chapters. And but I think that was passed down from generations. And then the implant itself is that one is a Zimmer product. I don't always use Zimmer, but they have some good things, and that's one of them.
Yeah. Okay, what now? Do you also do it with the humerus?
So this is our most exciting technology is the reverse total shoulder. Mm-hmm. We learned from the sports world makes up for a deficient rotator cuff.
Right.
And previously, our tumor prosthesis in the shoulder were just a glorified spacer. And we would try different things, like even using aortic grafts to get the head to stay in the socket.
Wait a minute. An aortic graft? A graft from the aorta?
Well, a synthetic aortic graft. So a graft that they actually use to replace an aorta.
Oh, okay.
We would use it because it's a tube.
Okay.
Made of Dacron or a tough synthetic material. And so we would suture that tube down to the glenoid or the socket of the shoulder joint and wrap it around the implant and in hopes of really holding that implant steady. Because we had such problems with it wanting to migrate when you don't have a rotator cuff.
It comes forward anteriorly?
Mm-hmm. It wants to come forward. Because oftentimes we're taking the rotator cuff, of course, when we have to take the proximal humerus for a tumor. Yeah. So then we found as long as we can preserve the deltoid, when we use this reverse technology, we can change the socket to a ball and the ball to a socket.
That's right.
And get it to reduce and really stay in. And it's been a big, great game changer. Now people who could barely move their shoulder are combing their hair and swimming and doing overhead activities with these.
Yeah. Wow. So would you say that's one of the most advanced techniques you're doing right now?
Yeah, that's been a newer technology that's developed. And the main the prostheses have just gotten FDA approved within the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. So this is a really new technology. I was putting it in before that just because we knew there were no other options. And we discussed it with the patients, say we're going to have, this will be off label, but it is by far the better option compared to our older technology. So we had a little bit of a head start, but now it's off to the races with the FDA approval.
So you guys are leading the field in that surgery.
Well, yeah, and it's not just me, but the orthopedic oncologists in general, a lot have adopted it.
Yeah. You'll hear more of this conversation with Dr. Allison right after this. If you're in the market for a bike, you want to buy your bike from a shop that has great service. Bicycles need to be serviced and maintained on a regular basis for safety. You want a relationship you can count on with the shop where you buy your bike. Helen's cares as much about servicing your bike and keeping you safe as it does about the sale of a new bike. Their tune-up packages and excellent repair service will keep your bike in perfect working order. Go to helenscycles.com. That's helenscycles.com. We're back with Dr. Chris Allison. Okay, the next thing that I read on your website, you do advanced joint reconstruction. Can you give me an example of something that you had never seen before? Like, it's like, oh, what am I going to do here? I have to figure something new out.
One of my patients came to me where he had almost his entire hemipelvis resected for a tumor.
So that means half of the pelvis has been taken out.
And he just had a little bit of the iliac crest, which is the top part of the pelvis bone attaching to the spine. And otherwise, not much else. And he'd gone all around the country, including Mayo Clinic and all sorts of places. And they said, there's really no reconstructive option for you. And he was having so much pain because it was just unstable.
Yeah.
Sometimes people can do okay where it scars in and it's somewhat stable enough to put weight on. But he couldn't get around without crutches, a walker, or a wheelchair. And he was having a lot of nerve pain because it was stretching his nerves whenever it was pushing up.
Which and nerves were being in the whole pelvic area?
Yeah, the whole lumbosacral plexus. Yeah, so both all the nerve roots that turn into the sciatic nerve and the femoral nerve were just being pulled upwards and stretched.
Every time he stepped down.
Every time he stepped down. Mm-hmm. And to the point where he said, well, look, if there's nothing to be done, I just want it amputated. It would be better for me to have it amputated. And so he had actually found a company in England called Stanmore Orthopedics, who's recently bought by Stryker. But at the time, they were very revolutionized. They had a program that they like to call extreme orthopedics, meaning the end stage stuff.
Yeah.
And they liked it. And a lot of the big companies don't like it because it's not a lot of volume, so it doesn't make them money, and it's very time intensive and expensive. But they liked it. And so they said, we can make an implant for you. If we get a CT scan, get our engineers involved, we'll make a custom implant to fit your pelvis and ways to fix it. And you just need to find a surgeon. And they actually gave him my name, and I'm not quite sure how they got it. But he showed up here and said, I need to talk to you. I need you to do this. And I said, wow, that's a big defect.
And were you like rubbing your hands saying, this is going to be fun and something new and creative, or were you kind of scared?
Absolutely. All of the above. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, this is in medicine, I love making people better, but the last thing I want to do is make anybody worse. Yeah. So you always think of what's the worst thing that could happen and really carefully weighed the risk and benefits and figured the worst thing that could happen in this surgery is probably not much worse than what he's got already. Mm-hmm. So it looks like a good opportunity to make things better. And so it took us 9 months to get the implant here. Between working with the engineers in England and going back and forth and saying, no, I want screw holes here. And they said, no, you can't do that. It'll weaken the implant. And it's really fun working with engineers. I really like it.
And they were having fun working with your expertise of knowing what was going to work or not.
I hope so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, they made one implant. They didn't like it. They remade the implant again. Then we had to get it through approved through the FDA as a custom device. Mm-hmm. And that took a while. And then it had to get shipped through here and passed through
customs. Did that take a lot of time?
That did. It got held up in Dallas for a couple of weeks. And we were getting close to the down to the wire for surgery. And
why was there a time limit?
We had put it on the schedule, and the patient really wanted to go, we would have postponed this case if it hadn't gotten here, but it ended up getting here before. I wanted to see it with my own eyes before we went into surgery, obviously.
What did you think when you saw it the first time?
It was impressive. It was beautiful. It's a thing of beauty. I've got pictures of it still, and they coated it with silver because there's been some good studies that show if you coat implants with silver, it reduces their infection rate with these cancer prostheses because they're more prone to infection because it's bigger surgery, more open wound, and larger surface area of metal.
And probably their immune system has been knocked down from all the cancer treatments.
And usually that's a factor as well. Yeah. And the pelvic endoprosthesis like this, even the one smaller than this, carried a 33% infection rate. Ooh. So one in three. So there's a high risk for infection with this case. So we got the silver coating. And the company said it was the largest pelvis prosthesis, endoprosthesis they'd ever made. Wow. And this company does the really extreme ones. So it's a decent likelihood it was the largest pelvic prosthesis ever put in a person. And so we were super excited. Uh-huh. It was the only case of the day, of course. And then I had vascular surgeons on standby, urologists on standby, because we had to go through and open up that pelvis and create that space again. And all the vessels had scarred together and the nerves. Oh. Fortunately, they didn't have to scrub in, but it was nice having them as a security blanket.
Yeah, yeah.
And it took us 7 hours and opened up the pelvis, really exposed everything well. The implant fit like a glove. Oh. They did a beautiful job. The screws that we put in to fix it up top had to go through the sacrum, and we went into the other ilium on the other side. So these, we call them transsacral screws.
So it goes all the way across.
Yeah, that we use them for trauma when people have a pelvic ring injury. So because of my training at LA County, I felt very comfortable putting those screws in. But it's tricky because you have to dodge the canal and the nerve and the neural foramen where the nerve roots come out. But they had the paths for the screw tunnels that the engineers had made were in perfect position. So when I followed those paths, we looked at the x-ray, it was just where it needed to be. So they did a remarkable job making this thing, and we were able to get all those screws across and get great fixation, because that's the part I was worried about. And if you don't get good fixation, you don't get good bone ingrowth. And if this doesn't grow in, then it's a big problem. And
covered with silver, how is it going to grow into that implant?
The main silver coating is around away from the bone ingrowth surface.
Okay.
But you can actually coat the HA, hydroxyapatite coating is the porous coating that we had. And the bone really loves to heal to hydroxyapatite because a lot of what bone is hydroxyapatite. And it has a porous surface with approximately 50 microns between the pores, and that's the optimal bone ingrowth. And if you can get it to not move more than 50 microns and have that kind of ingrowth surface,
it's in the right place.
Then you've got the sweet spot and it grows in.
Yeah.
And then the one place we cannot put silver is the bearing surface because it'll rub off.
Mm-hmm.
And so the bearing surface was a traditional polyethylene liner.
The femoral head.
And the ceramic femoral head.
And the acetabulum that you had to create.
Yeah, so the acetabulum was part of the implant. And then that we cemented in a polyethylene liner.
Uh-huh.
The old Charnley technique.
Wow.
And the funnest part of that was using a minimally invasive femoral stem that I designed for minimally invasive surgery, but it works really well, especially in young people's bone. And so it's a little bit ironic. On one side, you have the biggest pelvis prosthesis you can get, and on the other side, we have a short, minimally bone-preserving femoral stem. Because we didn't need to do a long stem on the femur.
I hope you wrote this up. Do you have a videotape? Do you have it all documented?
Yeah, we're submitting it for a case report. I wanted to give it a couple of years to see how he did. And it's been over a couple of years. And he walks without a cane and is very happy with it.
Well, that's quite a story. Yeah, but you still feel a certain amount of success and yet concern at the same time.
Yeah, and we take it day by day. But we were really happy we could get that done safely.
And right now, you've led the way on doing things like this. People won't be as afraid.
Yeah. And he actually went back to Mayo and touched base with them and said, you know, this is possible. Because the surgeon was very gracious who told him it couldn't be done and was very happy to hear that we had done it.
Well, I suspect all that time that you worked at County USC, where all this trauma was coming in of all kinds, has set you up to be able to keep a certain amount of calm and confidence as you face things you haven't seen.
I would like to think so. I definitely saw that in my attendings that taught me. And certainly when you have the confidence, I think that comes from experience. And one of my favorite quotes is from a surgeon who said, "I can handle any complication because I've caused them all."
I know what I did, so I know how to fix it.
So even with that confidence is also a great deal of humility, because certainly we're all not perfect. And you know, you're always ready for any mistake that could happen, because you know it's anything's possible.
Well, the third thing on your website says advanced skeletal trauma. And wow. You know, so I mean, I know what it's like to deal with a challenge, but is there anything that still can show up and it's like, oh, I've never seen this before?
Well, I like to say that fractures are like snowflakes. There's no two ones are identical. We classify them, and they're very common patterns that we see. But I think each one has its own personality, both in terms of where it's broken, how it got broken, the soft tissue damage that's associated with it, the other injuries, you know, do they have their arms and legs broken as well, or is it just one side? And then the person themselves, what their job is, what their life is like, what their expectations are.
All that.
And you put it together, and every single one is different, and you put all those into account. But some are more severe than others, and certainly one of my patients that has had such a severe accident, if you saw the car, you wouldn't believe that anyone could even have been removed from the vehicle. And they ended up writing a book about it. And I was fortunate enough to be involved with their care. And I can't remember the number of bones broken, but it was, I think, about 18.
Oh, my goodness.
Throughout the body. And it was a great team effort with the trauma surgeons, the neurosurgeons, myself, and all the nurses and all the therapists. And she was on the Megyn Kelly Show just a few months ago.
Oh, she's walking and...
walking and talking and...
moving her arms.
Yeah, you wouldn't be able to tell anything had ever happened.
How long ago? Was it a couple of years ago? I'm guessing.
Yeah, we took care of this. This was probably 3 years ago.
3 years ago, yeah. How long would it take to recover from all of that?
Yeah.
I read that in 2015, you signed up for the Naval Reserve. What has happened since 2015? Have you been deployed?
Yeah, so I signed up for the reserves partly because of my experience at LA County. It's a Navy Trauma Training Center, and I got to see the corpsmen and the surgeons before they went over to Iraq and Afghanistan, and I was just very, very impressed. So as a trauma chief, we always tried to get all the cases done so you wouldn't be unloading a bunch of cases on the next day, and we got busy at LA County. And sometimes in the county system, things don't always flow as well as maybe in a more capitalistic system.
Yeah.
But if you got the Navy room, you knew you were going to get your cases done, because they were on it and they were efficient and they wanted to be there and they wanted to work. And I just loved being around them. And I said, these are the type of people that I want to be associated with and I want to be like. And I kept making excuses to not do, oh, I've got to pay off loans. Oh, I've got to do this and I've got to build my practice. And finally, I said, you know, I can't make any more excuses. And
what's the latest age you can get into that?
39. So that was, you know, deadline was coming up, and and ISIS was taking hold, and they were executing Americans and executing children.
Yeah.
And whatever your politics are and how we got into Iraq, no one can argue that, you know, we're there, that we've got to deal with what we've got. Mm-hmm. And it's a vacuum and allowing things, barbarians like ISIS to take over and do terrible things. And we can't allow that. And so, and I wanted to give back to the country that gave me so much, where I wasn't even supposed to go to college. And I got so much great opportunity. So I knew I had to do it. And it was one of the scariest things I've ever done, making the oath. And it was also one of the best things I've ever done. And I so recently got selected to join Operation Inherent Resolve in Iraq to fight ISIS and establish stability in the region. And I went to for 6 months to south of Mosul and just got back in December.
What were those 6 months like? What were you doing?
I was on a Army base. It's a joint forces mission. So Army now works with the Navy, with the Marines, with the Air Force. And also we had Canadians on the base and Finns and British. So joint force and coalition force mission. And I was on a 1 square mile base for 6 months. And
you stayed there the whole time.
The whole time. We didn't leave. It was not a stable area, so we were not allowed to leave. And we were very well protected, though. Mm-hmm. And we supported the Special Forces strikes as we just took out the remaining pockets of ISIS. We also supported the Iraqi army as they hoped to take over their government and establish stability. We don't want to be their government. We just want to help them get established. So we set up a system, kind of we tried to imitate our system when we took over America as Americans and patriots from the British. And so we tried to teach them the same kind of philosophy of independence. And we're helping their medical care. And their doctors don't have the training that we have, but we're so eager to learn.
I'll bet.
And they certainly had the experience and would see the things, and they didn't have the resources or the training, so we were there to give it to them and then also take care of course, our own service members who are putting their lives at risk.
Did you like see a SEAL team or another kind of special forces team go out and then someone have to come back and you work on them?
Yeah, so that's what we did a lot of times was they're more joint special forces, JSOC. So they combine the best of the best from all the different special forces and do these heroic missions. And part of their mission is built in an evacuation plan.
Yeah.
And so they would come up and investigate, you know, just based on where their mission was. They wanted to be within that golden hour. And they'd come up to us before and look at our facilities and talk to us and say, okay, this is where we want to go.
So they go in there knowing that I'm going to be coming back here if anything happens. Wow. Yeah.
But that's what we do. And whether it's the host country or our own forces, the medical backup is extremely important for morale. Mm-hmm. You know, these people are willing to put their lives on the line to help us and spread freedom throughout the world, but they want to know, at least know that if they get hurt, they've got a chance.
Put my leg back on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And that's what I signed up for, was to be that chance.
Give me one of the coolest stories of one of those heroes coming in.
You know, luckily for us, it was quiet. Like Mosul was very busy and there were terrible injuries. And I can't get too much into all the details. They were very safe, but we did have IED injuries. Mm-hmm.
An IED is what?
Oh, sorry. Improvised explosive device. Mm-hmm. Kind of like a landmine, but a disorganized landmine, but even more lethal. Mm-hmm. And it creates these blast injuries, a combination of blast, penetrating trauma, and thermal injury that's devastating. And not to mention all the others, the effects of the blast wave that can cause traumatic brain injury and blunt trauma throughout the whole body. So the devastating injuries.
Did you have any of those come back to you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you take care of them as best as you can. Our job at that facility was, it's called a Role 2 facility. So life, limb, and eyesight, meaning we just took care of life-threatening injuries, limb-threatening injuries, and eyesight-threatening. We ended up doing more than that just because we wanted to do our jobs and stay busy.
Yeah.
But as a Role 2 facility, we were operating in a tent and we didn't have a lot in the way of resources. So we would stabilize and then get them on the next CCAT plane out to go to the Role 3 facility in Baghdad or to Longstuhl, Germany.
Well, yeah, I know Germany's one of the places that they send a lot of people too.
Yeah.
Wow, you just got back in December. Are you all the way back in America now?
I'm getting there. Yeah, I went to work right away. There were some delays getting back, and I do hip replacements in the children at Children's Hospital. And it's an amazing field because many people who do joint replacements don't like to work with kids, so they don't have experience with the kids.
Different size, different shape. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the pediatric orthopedic surgeons don't get much joint experience. And when these kids need a joint replacement, it's usually very complex and very severe deformity, not an easy one. And so there's an unmet need, and the kids in the past have been told, you know, just deal with it and limp around until you're 40, and then we'll give you a hip replacement. And now our hip replacements are getting so good, and our bearing surfaces are so good, and that we feel more confident and doing something for these kids. And there's so many of them out there. So I had a couple of kids that had to start school in January. They were waiting for me to get back, and we put them on the schedule for, I think, December 14th. And I got back in on December 12th.
Whoa.
And so I thought I was going to get back in on December 1st, but it didn't work out that way. We had delays getting out. And so we was right back to work right away. And fortunately, those cases went great. And the kids got back to school in January and it worked out fine. But I had a quick transition back. People had always told me, oh, you know, you need to take a month off before you to readjust. And I didn't listen, but I transitioned back just fine.
Well, the fact that you had two great successes with two kids, I'm sure was wonderful way
that
to
helps,
come back.
That definitely helped.
And I'm sure everybody here at Cedars is really glad that you're back with all the experience that you have to be able to handle whatever shows up. And I want to thank you for all this time you've given me.
Oh, you're very welcome. My pleasure.
Meet the Doctors.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. You've been listening to Dr. Chris Allison from Cedars-Sinai, who can handle virtually any trauma-related orthopedic complication. If you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode as we speak with the brightest minds in medicine, research, surgery, and much, much more. I'm Linda Huey. You can tweet to me on Twitter at Linda Huey. That's LYNDAHUEY. Say hi or tell me who you'd like to hear on Meet the Doctors. Thanks to production assistant James Cowan and to Tom Struther for audio post-production.